explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe, of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, the desert near the Idaho and Canadian borders. We're glad you're with us tonight. The solar wind is a mid-range, 471.2 kilometers per second, and little sunspots 987, 988, and 989 are beginning to decay, but not before delivering a couple of M-class solar flares last week. These are not solar cycle 24 sunspots. These are ones left over from cycle 23. They are rather large, but are forward polarized and equatorial, so they don't pack the kind of punch it takes to change the weather on the Earth. As you might know, cosmic rays are caused by strong solar protons striking the upper atmosphere of Earth. These rays cause not only lights in the higher altitudes, but also light cloud cover. This high-altitude cloud cover blocks the sun's infrared radiation, which results in the Earth beginning to cool. Over the next 25 years, we could see very strong X-class flares from the sun. These would not only disrupt sensitive electronics, but could trigger other high-latitude ice ages. We'll keep you informed, but start shopping for property away from the coast and south of St. Louis if you'd like to see spring after the year 2033. What are those twinkling things in the sky? Oh, stars! Last night, millions of people in 100 cities switched off their lights for 1 hour to draw attention to the problem of climate change. Skies over urban areas darkened, allowing stars overhead a rare appearance. Organizers of Earth Hour declared it a remarkable global event. Never before have people from so many different backgrounds, cultures, and geographies come together to press for urgent action. I'd like to say even Google got into the act. They changed their search page to one of black so people could see. Geomagnetic storms that spark auroras seem to prefer the months around equinoxes. Why auroras should appear most often in the spring and fall has long puzzled space physicists. Recently, however, NASA's fleet of Themis spacecraft have uncovered new clues to the mystery. It is a puzzle worthy of many spacecraft. Underlying each display of pretty lights is a potent geomagnetic storm. Themis observed one recently with a total energy of 500,000 billion joules. That's approximately equivalent to the energy of a magnitude 5 earthquake, says Angelopoulos. Possible side effects of such storms range from satellite malfunctions to home power outages. Telecommunications, air travel, and GPS systems are always vulnerable. In a society that relies increasingly on space technology, understanding substorms is vital. The satellites have detected magnetic ropes connecting Earth's upper atmosphere directly to the sun, says Dave Seebeck, project scientist for the mission at the Goddard Space Flight Center. We believe that solar wind particles flow in along these ropes, providing energy for geomagnetic storms and auroras. It turns out that rope-like magnetic connections between sun and Earth are favored in springtime. It's a matter of geometry. As Earth goes around its orbit, Earth's tilted magnetic poles make different angles with respect to the sun, tipping back and forth with a one-year cadence. Around the time of the equinox, Earth's magnetic field is best oriented for connecting up with the sun. But wait, there are two equinoxes, spring and fall, with similar magnetic geometry. Indeed, studies show that fall is aurora season two. Geomagnetic disturbances are almost twice as likely in spring and fall versus winter and summer, according to 75 years of historical records analyzed by solar physicist Dave Hathaway of the Marshall Space Flight Center. Last week we ran an archive from the best of X Squared Radio because I was on the road back to Washington State. We're coming to you live from our studio in eastern Washington State, the deserts near the borders of Idaho and Canada. This week, we have a fellow Earth explorer. He is a filmmaker, an international speaker, and has sailed further than most men have dreamed. His latest work, The Great Pyramid, Lost Legend of Enoch, is one of the best documentaries on the mystery of the Great Pyramid you can buy. He is our guest tonight. Please welcome Ken Klein. How are you, Ken?
I'm well, and yourself?
I'm doing fantastic. I've watched this film about three times, and I still have a whole bunch of pages of notes. Very, very fascinating work. I can't wait to get into it. How are you doing?
I'm well. I'm down here working, actually, on our third part of the trilogy of the Great Pyramid. We finished the second one. It's called Message from the Stars. The third one is called The Gateway to the Galaxy. The Message from the Stars is already, by the way, on our website, so people, whoever hasn't seen it, they can purchase it there at our website. It's also downloadable, and if they are impulsive enough to want to buy it from pay-per-view, they can get it as well. It's a lot cheaper
that way. That's fantastic. That is fantastic. I know there are few, if any, subjects that excite the curiosity of people like the Great Pyramid. Now, many people think that there are other buildings like it, and that's just not so. So I want your opinion about this. I know some people think that there was some practice pyramids, like the Saqqara before the Great Pyramid was built. We're going to get into a lot of detail about that. So remember, Earth Explorers, this is a three-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, be sure to let us know. It's just three short hours, too, and it'll take every bit of it to cover this in 1/100th part. I want to know if you think the pyramid was the first or the final pyramid of the series in Egypt.
Are you asking me or the audience? I wasn't sure.
Well, I'm asking you, but we do have a lot of callers.
The Great Pyramid was, although it's been explained as being in the Fourth Dynasty, I believe the Great Pyramid was the first pyramid built in Egypt, and all the other pyramids were acts of devotion, almost like a sacrament to build other pyramids to remind the people of what really took place, as which caused the building of the Great Pyramid. And so all the other pyramids in Egypt were subsequent to the Great Pyramid.
Wow, that's pretty powerful stuff. I know that kind of infringes on certain franchises, and we're going to get into that a lot too in the third hour. There are one of the amazing things about the pyramid is there are star systems that were visible in those days, but also had alignments that predate the construction, the reported construction, by millennia. So how did they know of these star structures when telescopes were yet to be invented?
Well, this gets into why I believe the Great Pyramid was the first pyramid built, because the science that went into the Great Pyramid is not even closely duplicated in any other pyramid in Egypt. There were so many things that were built into the Great Pyramid that defy what you would expect people to have known at that time, that it makes it abundantly clear when you study the different attributes of the Great Pyramid that it had to be built by some kind of superior intelligence. It wasn't in the province of mankind alone to have built in all of these features. So there was a time in the Egyptian mythologies and legends, and even in the histories of people like Josephus, who was a great Jewish historian around the first century, that wrote of a time of the gods, small g, a time when there was actually a connectivity between these gods, and in the Old Testament they're called Elohim, which is a name that people use for God, small, large g, but actually Elohim is a name that derives its development from the word Eloah. And so it's a plural of the word Eloah. Eloah is the name only used once in the Old Testament for the Most High God. And so Elohim is a reference to angels or messengers. So there was a time when there were messengers on the earth, and they didn't really cavort with everybody. They just associated with a select group of people to whom they gave very esoteric information, and whom were the ones that designed and built the Great Pyramid. And so that's why you find so much science, astronomy, mathematics, geometry, all kinds of things built into the Great Pyramid that was given to these individuals on the earth by the gods or the messengers. In the Bible, they're called angels, which is the word we always get a mind picture of these beings that flap around with wings. But actually, there's references in the Old Testament that these beings came in ships. Now, that's a shock to people that are of the Christian faith, but there's plenty of scripture that indicates that these beings came here in ships. And so there was one man who was considered to be head and shoulders above all men at that time. His name was Enoch, and he's mentioned in the Old Testament. And he was of such a mental acuteness that he actually was so superior that he actually escaped death. He never died. And it says he was taken off the earth. And so it was Enoch, we allege, who was the architect of the Great Pyramid, and he lived around 3100 B.C., so that was about the time that the Great Pyramid was built. Now, history declares that it was built around 2400 to 2500 B.C. by this Pharaoh Khufu, but that's ludicrous, and we prove it in our films. But history, mythology, tradition has buried over the truth and the mysteries of the time, And so we have all of this traditionalism that has clouded the issue and kept us from the truth about what the pyramid was built for and who it was built by. So we believe it was built about 3100 to 3200 BC. It was designed by Enoch, who got the special privy information, esoteric information from messengers who were on the earth at that time. We see many mythologies, like in the Grecian mythology, of these giants that were on the earth, Nephilim, that is a whole other story where there was a whole different type of world at that time. And Enoch received information from these messengers, and it was he that was the architect and the builder of the Great Pyramid.
Why do you think that they picked the star system that they picked for these air shafts in the pyramid to point to? Why did they pick, what was it, Draconis?
Well, in the king, what is called the king's chamber, which is also a misnomer, because there was no king ever buried in there, and that's an incredible story we explain in the second film called Message from the Stars. And the reason we believe there was no king there, and I'll get to the air shafts in a minute, was because that coffer, which they call a funerary, sarcophagus, was not brought in through the passageways of the Great Pyramid. It was too big for the passageway, so it had to be dropped in from above. And so that would have necessitated a whole different funerary procession for a pharaoh, because pharaohs were always carried in to their burial place in their sarcophagus. But this one couldn't have gone through the passageways. It had to be dropped in from above, which meant that once the pyramid was closed over and sealed, there was no way to bring a pharaoh up in there. So the coffer was designed as a memorial, a monument, and the shafts that you find inside of what is called, like I said, a misnomer, the king's chamber, pointed to two places. The northern shaft, which they call an air duct, points to a place called Alpha Draconis, and at that time, Alpha Draconis. We get the word draconian or dragon from the word draconius. And this is mentioned in the Apocalypse, in the 12th chapter of the Apocalypse or the Book of Revelation, as a place where there was a war, a Star Wars, or a war amongst the messengers. There was a messenger war, an angel war. And it was believed that it took place at this star system, Alpha Draconis. And that war affected our present condition here on the earth. So it pointed to a place where there was war in the heavens, or the in our galaxy, and it points to that place where everything began to have an impact on this world. Secondly, the other air shaft or the duct points to the location of Orion, which is where Enoch went. He was taken into the area of Orion, and Orion was a headquarters for the cherubim messengers, or the cherubim angels. And those are the angels that are called the Watchers, that some of them defected and had, became evil, and have their own ships. Those are, I think, many of the things that we see in the skies. Well, many of the things we see in the skies also are angel ships, or messenger ships of the good kind. So there's two kinds of UFOs. There's the evil kind of the fallen watchers, and then there's the good kind, those that watch over the human race to keep us from destroying ourselves. So there's two kinds of ships, and most of the time people think that all of the UFOs are evil or aliens, but some of them are good, and many of them are good, and they watch over us to keep us from destroying the world. That's why you hear a lot of reports where missiles that are armed with nuclear warheads are disarmed. Some have been disarmed on the ground, some of them in space. So, and the evil ones are only allowed certain abilities. They are not allowed to really attack us and hurt us. They're limited by the good ones. So, the Orion was where Enoch was taken into the stars, and that's where he presently. Well, he actually has been moved to Arcturus, which is a whole other story. But anyway, that's why those shafts point to those places.
Well, now, do they point to those places now, or did they point to those places when the pyramid was built, or did they point to those places at some point in the future after the pyramid was built?
Alpha Draconis at one time was, you know, the north, the polar star. It's kind of moved somewhat since that time. Orion, I think, is, I'm not sure about Orion, to be honest with you. I don't know the answer to that question, but at least I know at the time that they were aimed there, that's where they were aimed.
It just seems interesting that that much energy, that much architecture, design, and engineering would be put into a building that was going to pointed to stars during the time of the construction. It would seem that that it would be kind of an edifice to, or an instrument to facilitate perhaps the transportation of Enoch from this world to that world when the two lined up correctly.
No, that's not what happened. The pyramid really, even though today, and this will, when we get into our next trilogy, which will be the Mysteries of the Enochian Priesthood, that's coming next year, we'll talk about the template and the purpose for the Great Pyramid as it pertains to our own understanding of spirituality. But in Enoch's case, his transcendence really didn't have anything to do with the knowledge that was encrypted into the pyramid. He already had that within himself, so he didn't need what he left behind. So that's left behind for us to understand as a prophecy. But he didn't need that to be shot into space. He left this earth in a ship. You know, and like for example, in First, we find many scriptures in the Old Testament. For example, one of them is a tucked away place in 1 Chronicles 28:18. It says when King David is talking to his son Solomon, he says, listen, Solomon, when you build the artifacts for the temple, this was talking about the Jewish temple that hadn't been built yet, make sure you make a model or a copy of the chariots of the cherubim. And a chariot was basically a generic word that explained a means of conveyance. So the cherubim fly in chariots or ships. And it was a ship that took Enoch. He didn't just fly up into space. He flew up in a ship, and he was taken by messengers. And he was taken into the area that I spoke of, Orion, and then he was moved eventually to Arcturus. And that's where he is now. He's still alive. So, and he's coming back according to the New Testament reports in the book of Jude. He's coming with 10,000 ships. And that's going to be quite a sight. But anyway, he didn't need the temple, the templated meaning of the pyramid to have escaped, you know, potential. That was something that was left for the world, but has been, of course, you know, clouded over by tradition and myth and the provincial view of history that the pyramids were the tombs of the pharaohs. It's simply not true. In fact, no pyramid in any part of Egypt was there ever found the mummy of a pharaoh. None of them. If there were mummies, they were put outside. In other burial sites, and those were robbed. But the pyramids, none of the pyramids contained mummies of the pharaohs.
Yeah, it's pretty common that it's known that they weren't buried in the pyramids, but there's no small amount of legend or even superstition about strange powers and energies and even revelations that have been had by people who enter and lay in what might be called the dream chamber inside the king's chamber. There's a lot of energy in this place.
Well, you know, anybody can have a dream, or anybody can conjure up anything within their, what we call the chambers of our imagery, because every person alive has an imagination, and the imaginations can run wild anything you want to focus on. I mean, that's the problem with our imaginations. They run to all kinds of extremes. I'm not saying people can't have a really honest-to-goodness revelation. I'm just saying that most of that stuff to me is a bunch of hocus-pocus and doesn't really mean a lot, and I don't put a lot of stock in it. The pyramids throughout Egypt were built as a religious devotion unto the first pyramid, which expressed what was talked about in Isaiah 19, a monument in the land of Syriad. Syriad was Cairo, that would be in the midst and the border thereof. And the midst means in the middle, and the border means at the edge. So how could that be? Well, when you find out there were two kingdoms, a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom, and the Gaza, or Giza, I should say, is Means border, the pyramid splits those two kingdoms right down the middle, and it perfectly fits the description that was given by the prophet Isaiah of a monument unto the Lord of hosts, or angels, or messengers, and that's exactly what the pyramid is, a monument that was to memorialize an event that took place at that time in the history of this world, an event that was so mind-shattering that the people of Egypt never recovered from it, and that event was this guy, Enoch, who was called Toth, or Hermes, or Dehuti, at that time, and he escaped the world. And for that, from that time on, the Egyptian people were never the same. They continually thought about the afterlife. They weren't consumed with death. They were consumed with what is called the eternal day. And the eternal day was announced as a metaphor of a day that would never end, or eternal life, immortality. And that's what Enoch achieved. He achieved escape velocity from death, and he left the earth and never died. And that event was so monumental and still is. Every other person in history has died. Even Jesus died. He rose again, but this man never died. And that was an event that so changed the world that the whole Egyptian religion came from that event. And the Great Pyramid was a memorialization of that event with an empty coffer suggesting that there was nobody there. Nobody ever died. And from that time on, pyramids were built as a sacrament or a religious observance of that event. And over time, the whole mystery of it was lost through, embellishments and, stories that were fabricated, and they became myths. And even Toth, who was just a messenger, became idolized as a god. So, all of those things that began to cover over, and the mysteries of the Enochian priesthood were lost, and now they're being uncovered. And that's what our films are all about.
Well, I all this is completely fascinating, and there's no way we can cover all that in 3 hours. I one of the people asked me one time, when one walks around the Sphinx, it's easy to see that there are docks that were once used by small ships that came up the river to park right in front of the two structures, or even by sea. It's not so hard to see when you're there, but the river and the surrounding area did not have its lush green landscape after about 9,000 BC, that there would have been no reason to come to this point with royal ships unless this complex was in fact built and flourishing. Isn't it clear that these structures were built long before the first pharaoh and even before Egyptus came to this land?
Well, I don't agree with it being built that long ago. They have done radiocarbon dating of the mortar in the joints of the Great Pyramid. And the radiocarbon dates clearly refute Herodotus, who claimed that the pyramid was built in 30 years, because the radiocarbon dating goes back to about 3900 BC all the way to 2800 BC. So the radiocarbon dating, if you want to look for some precise information about the exact date of the Great Pyramid, And you want to put any credence to radiocarbon dating, which I tend to believe it's pretty authentic, then that would locate the timing of the building of it between 2800 and 3900 BC. So the date as far back as 9000, I don't think is that's a pretty speculative idea if you're going to not look at the science. And then if you go to some of the writings of Khufu himself, who wrote in the inventory stela, which we have today, that he did repair work on it. The only way he could have done repair work on it would have been when the casing stones were taken off of it. And then you're back to the whole issue of the radiocarbon dating again. So I don't see the date being back to 9,000. I think it's more in the area of 2800 to 3900 BC. And even the date on 3900, there's only been one sample of that taken, and it's a little bit different than all the other samples. So actually, if you average the dates out of the radiocarbon dating, it's right around 2900 to 3100 BC. And I think that's most likely when it was built. Now, I think the River Nile was closer to the pyramid at that time. I don't think there's any question about that, but I don't know how we come up with dates that far back. I don't think that when you look at all the evidence, it would support that late of a date, or early of a date, I should say.
Well, there are a couple of the pieces of evidence, and just let me address, you know, radiocarbon dating. Carbon has a pretty broad population of atomic weight, and what happens is carbon is energized by cosmic radiation at a fairly predictable rate, and then when that carbon is consumed or encapsulated in something, it immediately begins to decay because it's no longer exposed to the cosmic radiation. But in the mortar between the joints, the mortar is inorganic. It doesn't contain hardly any amounts of carbon. It's mostly calcium and other elements. So radiocarbon dating of inorganic material isn't really that accurate. It mostly works for things that have high levels or high populations of carbon in them. And then it's a statistical assay that is done, and it is fairly accurate, but only for organic compounds, not so much for inorganic compounds. So for something like mortar, even archaeologists will agree, and most geologists are pretty firm on, you really have to either find organic compounds in the inorganic, like a fossil inside.
Well, that's what I'm saying. They have found organic material in the mortar because they had to make the mortar with certain wood products at that time that where they made this slurry. A lot of those wood products, insects and so forth, organic material was found in the mortar. That's what they dated. It wasn't there's no dating capability in inorganic material. I agree with you. But there's other things to look at coinciding with those dates. And if you use the biblical record of the time of Enoch, it's about the same time as that coincides with the radiocarbon dating. Now, Enoch, it's interesting because you look at this man that lived, and you think, well, if he was such a great man, you know, wouldn't he have left some kind of footprint in Egyptian history that we could look at that would, you know, give us more ability to wrap our minds around such a colossal event? And when you go back through, you know, the mythologies in ancient civilizations, they're pretty amazing. For example, in Greek mythology, there was these titanic battles that kind of references some of the issues that took place between these giants that lived on the earth in those days, the Olympians, and I'm trying to think of the name of the other ones that fought, but their mythologies contain an element of biblical truth to them. And then when you look back through, for example, the Greek mythology that has to do with Hermes, Hermes in the Greek mythology was the messenger god. And Hermes the idea of Hermes was taken from the Egyptians. And so if you go into Egypt, there's a place maybe 200 miles south of Cairo called Hermopolis. And Hermopolis was set up around the 3rd or 4th century B.C. by the Ptolemies. And the Ptolemies were one of the generals of Alexander the Great that took over Egypt, became the king of Egypt. And he set up this place called Hermopolis in honor of Hermes. And Hermes was the god, the messenger god, who was adopted from the Egyptian culture. And in the Egyptian culture, he was known as Thoth. And Thoth was an interesting god in Egypt because there's many epitaphs of Thoth. I mean, they're unbelievable. When you read, there's hundreds of them. So he was a well-known god, very much loved, and he was the god of, like, Mot. And Mot meant truth. And he loved truth, and he brought, a righteous judgment to the people. And I could read you many of his epitaphs. Well, Thoth was also known as Dehuti, and the place that he lived where they memorialized him called Hermopolis was a place called Chem, K-H-E-M, and it's the word we get chemistry from. And chemistry was one of the sciences that Thoth was a master over because he was a master over a lot of things. He was master over astronomy, mastery over writing, mastery over justice. And you see him throughout Egypt in many of the papyrus shops as presiding over this thing called the Last Judgment, where you see these balances, wherein the balances are containing a human being's heart as it's measured against a feather. And when the feather outweighed the heart, it meant that that was a good person, and Thomas would make the judgment. So he was also God over the judgment. So he was a righteous man that over time became deified, idolized, and then mythologized. And so what is the connection between Thoth and Enoch? And when you go and look and see that Thoth was also the one that invented the lunar calendar, and you find also that Enoch, who was a righteous man, it's said of him in the Bible, and he was, in his book, the Book of Enoch, claimed all of these measurements of the moon, and he was known as the calendar man, you find that they're one and the same person. And when you study the dates of Enoch, biblically, all the way backwards, it's around 3100 B.C. So when you combine this whole matter of Thoth Enoch with radiocarbon dating, it comes out to right around the same date. And there's other things, too, that we can look at, and these come out of actually my third film called Gateway to the Galaxy, where we pretty much pinpoint the time of the building of the Great Pyramid to around 3100 B.C., and it's pretty phenomenal when you look at it through the mythological religious angle. And so it's not just radiocarbon dating that we're looking to. We just see that as supportive evidence to substantiate our claims that this was the time when the pyramid was built. Certainly wasn't built during the time of Khufu, who was allegedly given by Egyptian traditionalists the honor for building the Great Pyramid. Even he disavowed that in the inventory stela. So, you know, we're trying to break through the myths and the false legends and teachings, because the Great Pyramid really is an oracle and a prophecy hidden in stone.
Oh, there's no doubt about that, and we are definitely going to talk a lot more about that in the second hour. I wanted to go ahead and lay this groundwork. The Book of Enoch, which is not included in the canon recognized by general Christian religions, was fairly well preserved. It was preserved in Slavonic and then translated into English sometime in the early 19th century, about 1840, 1850. And it's kind of interesting that Jesus quoted the Book of Enoch 128 times in the New Testament, and yet the Book of Enoch is not included in the Scripture. And it's also interesting that this most remarkable engineering feat, I mean, obviously it stands out today in the 21st century. I'm sure it stood out in 3800 B.C. or 2800 B.C. Why is it not mentioned in any of the Christian scriptures? Did they expunge it from the record? What is your opinion on that?
Well, first of all, the Book of Enoch was widely used as for teachings from Jesus. He quoted it a few times, but many times he used it as his reference point for many of his teachings. It's also mentioned in the Book of Hebrews and the Book of Jude, and it was widely read in the first century by the Christian church. But by the time, and it was found, three volumes of it were found in Ethiopia and fragments of it in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So, it definitely was, a well-known and read book. It was considered scripture by many of the church fathers in the first three centuries. But in the third century, it was expunged from canonicity by Constantine's Council of Nicaea, and then it lost its visibility because it was not accepted in canonicity. So now, why not? And I would have to say that probably in many copies of it became distorted and probably there were a lot of errors in it, just like there's a lot of errors in the Bible. I mean, people don't know that about the Bible, but there are errors in the Bible. And they said, well, it's the Word of God. I said, well, yeah, but there's a lot of things been added by 17th century King James scholars that are not in the original. Well, we don't even have any original manuscripts of the Bible. We have codexes, that are the closest that we have. But, for example, in 1 John 5, You know, they have, there's a statement, there are three that bear witness in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Ghost. Well, that's not even in the original codexes. You know, it's an inputting of a false idea about the Trinity into the Bible. And it's not even a biblical concept, but it's widely accepted, you know, the Trinitarian view of God. But it's not biblical. It's
well,
really not. It's
one.
Just a coined term. So the Council of Nicaea, you know, had a lot to do with not allowing the book of Enoch in, but it's a very important book, and Jesus did quote it, and he did use it a lot of times for his messages. I wasn't aware of the number. I thought it was more like 115. What did you say it was?
128 references in the New Testament by Jesus.
128. I didn't realize it was that many. I thought it was about 115, but that's doesn't surprise me. But it's a very important book, and you know, Enoch... I don't remember what chapter of his book where he makes all of these amazing measurements of the moon, but that's an important data in our consideration of his relationship with the moon god. And he was called the moon god. Toth was called the moon god because he studied the movements of the moon through the aperture of the opening in the ceiling of the Grand Gallery, which was an observatory. And so, you know, the Great Pyramid is incredible. It's incredible what it's trying to tell us. And I remember when I was there, my first trip, I was about 3 or 4 years ago, we started this project. I had a guide there, and I said, I got to go inside the Great Pyramid. She goes, why? There's nothing to see. I said, I don't think you understand. The rocks talk to me. And they do. If you listen, they will tell you quite a story.
Well, I know that on the inside of the temple there is remarkable energy, and when you look at the placement and the machining of granite and basalt and limestone that it took to build this, and we're going to go into a lot of this detail in the second and third hour, because the engineering, if you just use basic engineering and scientific methodology to reverse engineer this structure, you will see that it is just impossible that the current historian's version of where the Great Pyramid came from and who built it is just impossible.
That's right.
One of the things that shows up in your film really early on, and I've noticed in other works, but you seem to lay it out a little more clearly than most, and that is the UFO records that are prolific in nearly all artworks in all ages. But it appears that they were not publicly ridiculed or even banned like they are today. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I know the answer to that. Before 1890, UFOs were considered benevolent and angelic before 1890. And then in the 1890s, there was a paradigm shift. And part of that came from this guy named Schiaparelli, who was an astronomer who developed the capacity to look at the planet Mars. And on the planet Mars, he saw these things which he called canali. And what that meant was not what we think. It didn't mean canals, but when it was translated in English, it came out that Schiaparelli discovered canals on Mars. So that was the beginning of the paradigm shift when people began to believe there was intelligent life forms on the planet Mars. And then in 1895 or so, 1896, H.G. Wells came out with his book, War of the Worlds. You know, and then, of course, in the 30s, I think it was, or 40s, there was a great scare with, what was the great broadcaster's name?
H.G. Wells, or
who broadcast the attack of... London, UFOs, and anybody who panicked was on. It was on Halloween night. What was his name?
Orson Welles.
Orson Welles. So ever since 1890s, everything now is anything that has to do with UFOs is cast in this darkness. And then, of course, the movie came out with Spielberg's movie years ago with Tom, whatever his name is, the famous actor.
It was Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah, and that was a different movie, but the latest one by that just came out in the last 5 or 10 years, you know, about War of the Worlds, they redid it. People tend to have this idea that UFOs are all evil, or they're just, you know, we don't understand them, and they have all these weird forms that we're seeing. But But before 1890, you know, in the artwork and tapestries and paintings, and even back before Christ, there are these renderings of beings that have halos around their head and come in ships. And, you know, it's in the history of the world. It's in caves and paintings. But before 1890, they were considered benevolent. And afterwards, they've taken on a sinister form. So we've had this paradigm shift in the way we view these things. And that's the history of it. So I try to go to, you know, ancient biblical records to prove that there were many excursions by messengers to this planet to try to help us, you know, open our eyes to transcendental existence. And that should be what we focus on in terms of, you know, who we are on this planet. And the pyramid, you know, it was constructed with a supernatural intelligence. There's no doubt about it. There's just no way humans could have known that. You know, for one thing, the people don't realize that the base of the pyramid is actually curved, and it's curved at the ratio of the circumference of the Earth. These people knew at least 3,000 BC, according to my records, that the Earth was round. They didn't even believe this until Columbus.
But
in the Great Pyramid, it was actually eight-sided and not four-sided. And we didn't know this until the 19th century, or the 20th century, when they discovered it by flying over it with airplanes, and they discovered the shadows, and then they measured it, and sure enough, the base of the pyramid is curved. But no other pyramid is built like that.
So it's kind of interesting to see the copies, even if you go to the south of there and you look at these. What historians have said, well, these were the earliest pyramids, like Saqqara and all of this, and these were actually the practice pyramids, and they got better and better and better, and finally they built the Great Pyramid. Every modern historian and geologist that I know knows that is utter rubbish.
If you look at the pyramids of the third dynasty, and of course they say the Great Pyramid was built in the fourth dynasty, and so it evolved into a greater artistry and with more understanding. But then if you look at the fifth dynasty pyramids, they revert back to the third dynasty pyramids. So what happened? Why did these guys get dumber after the fourth dynasty? And it just doesn't make any sense that there'd be this evolution and then all of a sudden this de-evolution. And of course, they try to explain it. Well, there were wars in Egypt. They just didn't have enough time to do the job right. And they come up with all these kind of excuses for their, historical viewpoint. But it all breaks down under careful scrutiny.
Yeah, we'll talk about those construction methods in the second hour. They're pretty amazing. You are going to be amazed if you're listening to this live. I know you're just hanging by your fingernails on the edge of your PC, and if you're listening on Monday or Tuesday in front of your favorite workstation while you're doing your day job, you're going to have your credit card in your hands, because we're going to give out a website here in about 5 minutes. We want you to go there and pick this film up, because you're going to have your mind blown by this documentary. If you read in the Book of Enoch, he talks about being taken off-world and shown distant places in the universe, and even shown the future. And he talks with the Nephilim. He talks with the giants. The giants are trying to negotiate getting off this world before the great flood comes. And Enoch pretty much turns them down flat, because their consciousness isn't high enough, or God doesn't think that they're going to get off this world. So I'm going to ask you this question. Do you think that off-world intelligence was used to build the Great Pyramid?
I need your help when you say off-world. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean perhaps that technology came from somewhere other than Earth.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The pyramid, we're talking about powerful beings called angels, whose intelligence so far surpasses human intelligence that we can't even calculate it. And so the knowledge of it, for example, the universal equation of pi is inscribed into the Great Pyramid. These people knew how to square a circle, In fact, if you took the radius, if you took from the base of the pyramid to the apex of the pyramid, and used that as a radius of the circle, that radius, if you circumscribe the circle with it, it would equal the perimeter of the pyramid. So these people knew how to square a circle because they understood the universal equation of pi. Now, where did that come from? We know that Pythagoras came up with that in the Grecian culture, but that was not for more than 2,000 years later. But Enoch received the knowledge of that from the messengers, the gods, and he built it into the Great Pyramid. And it's not just the apex of the pyramid. We get the knowledge of the circle also from the antechamber. So built into the Great Pyramid is this equation of pi. Now, where did that come from, and how did he know that at that time unless he was associating with angelic beings that understood this universal equation? And not only is pi in it, so is phi. And so there's a lot of other things in the Great Pyramid that he couldn't have known. How would Enoch have known that the Earth was round? And at least if he knew it was round, how did he know what the actual ratio of that was so he could build it in the Great Pyramid? Only a messenger from outside of this world could have known that. Not only that, the Great Pyramid is built in the exact center of the world's landmass. They didn't have, satellite technology in those days to know this stuff. And not only was it in the center of the world's landmass, it's the most perfect compass on the Earth. It's perfectly
set.
Northeast, southwest quadrants of the compass. Where did he get this knowledge from, if it didn't come from outer space or from angels or messengers, as I call them? It certainly was off-Earth knowledge at that time.
Do you think that these off-world engineers only worked with the people on the Nile, or do you think they worked with other settlements around the world?
That's a good question, because that brings into play the Mayan pyramids, and that's a whole other area that I don't want to get into tonight, but they certainly have a linkage with a whole area of Arcturus in our solar system, but that's a whole area that I just don't want to get into. I will tell you this, that the reason that Enoch was a recipient or a candidate to receive this esoteric information that now over the course of 5,000 years has become in many places, common knowledge, was because he had a pure heart. He was a righteous man, and he was upright in his heart, and so he could be contacted by holy messengers that would be able to impart to him this information. And
so
he knew that there was going to be a flood. He knew there was going to be a destruction of the Nephilim. And so he encrypted a lot of this information into the Great Pyramid so that, parchments would be destroyed, but a pyramid that would contain this information in rock would endure. And so much of the Great Pyramid was built with this incredible technology so that it would endure the long haul of human history and continue to hold in its, encrypted creation, this knowledge for us, so we would discover it as we woke up from our, spiritual amnesia. Pardon me?
Well, I was going to say, obviously, engineering of this importance and propulsion systems and abilities to travel at 10,000 miles an hour and make a left-hand turn would be of high interest to anyone who wanted to dominate the world. So having a pure heart and not being warlike and being trustworthy with this kind of engineering to actually leave a record and maybe help preserve the human race through a coming cataclysm might have been the precursor, might have been the qualification by which these particular off-worlders, these aliens, or these people from another world would impart such valuable information to one human being.
Absolutely. Absolutely the truth. Because the knowledge, certain types of knowledge is hidden and locked away, and it cannot be opened by evil people. They wouldn't have the setup in their internal being to unlock, this kind of knowledge. So it takes a person with a pure heart to be able to transcend human nature and be able to unlock these codes. So that's the point. That's why I'm saying other cultures where there's you know, people of high integrity, high character, and pure of heart are candidates to receive you know, information like that.
Well, it's often said, even in more esoteric circles today, that one has to have a higher vibration in their heart or a higher consciousness, or if you want to go as far as to say have a loving heart in order to understand these things, and that as soon as you turn toward dominion over another human being, your heart darkens and your understanding dims, and then these things mean nothing to you. And so if you're all about, you know, ruling the world or controlling the truth as it's doled out to people, like religions and governments have done since history has kept records, then you lose the understanding and the value of these things as they were left for us. But
absolutely,
those of us,
true,
you know, who become enlightened, who become inspired, I can use that word, even though this is a scientific program, what happens is you become enlightened, you become aware, you become unified, you become connected with things that may, or in fact do, exist off this world, in this galaxy, or in other galaxies, or even in other dimensions, which dark hearts or dark lower vibrational energies would be ignorant to. It wouldn't even show up on the scope. So they're trying to use tools like a pyramid for something that it was not designed to do. Then it's just going to sit there like a bunch of rock.
That's right. And then you see millions of people go there, and they just look at it and go, oh, ha ha, and they take pictures and they go home. They don't have a clue what the meaning of it is. It's just some, you know, it's the first wonder of the world, the only one remaining, and so they take a picture and go home and say, I was at the Great Pyramid. They have no clue what the meaning of it was, or what it means to them, or should mean to them, or could mean to them, and they stay in a darkened state. But,
well, in my opinion, I don't even think the Egyptians who are entrusted with being its caretaker today have a clue what it's there for or who built it.
Oh, absolutely true. They don't even know that they don't even know who built it or why it was built or what the importance of it is for the world. But because so much of their economy runs on tourism, you know, they protect their historical tradition, and then the truth is never uncovered. And so that's why we're doing what we're doing, because the Great Pyramid is the only artifact that we know of that is a construction from another dimension that was handed to man to build for the posterity and for the spiritual development of the human race. And that's why it's so important that people understand that this is a bridge, that this trilogy that we've created, and we're almost done with the third one now, we're about 30 days away from it being available, is so important, and opening so many pathways to true transcendence and a connectivity to the rest of our, heavenly, I should say, you know, heavenly family. There's a family above us that's trying to reach us and open our eyes. And we're down here on the earth, caught up in the values of this world that's in pretty bad shape, and
I
not able to
agree
see
more.
The truth.
I couldn't agree more. The film is called The Great Pyramid, Lost Legend of Enoch. Joseph Farrow with WorldNet Daily says it's the best film on the pyramids I've ever seen. The website is KenKleinProductions.net. You can find it at x2-radio.com. We are going to take a short break, about 5 or 6 minutes, and then we'll be back with more of Ken Klein. We're going to talk about this film. We're going to get into aspects of the pyramids you never imagined. So don't go away. We'll be back after this. Foundations of Religion and Science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared.
Have you ever thought about owning a telescope?
I mean a really good telescope.
Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio.
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back. To X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, where my AccuWindow forecast says it's about 29 degrees outside, stars twinkling even though it was snowing like mad this morning. Our guest tonight is Ken Klein. His film is called The Great Pyramid, Lost Legend of Enoch. We're going to open the phone lines this hour, so if you want to call in, we definitely want to hear from you. In U.S. or Canada, you can call toll-free at 888-228-4494. And in Canada, we also have a toll-free number for you, 877-489-6350. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-776-5154. And if that line is busy, you can reach us at 530-776-5185. If you're using Skype, you can reach us simply at BBS Radio. And if you're using PalTalk, you can reach us at BBSRadio.com. All of these phone numbers are listed on the website at x2-radio.com. Does a boomerang thrown in space return to its pitcher? It does. If it was thrown inside an airy environment like the International Space Station, a Japanese astronaut proved last week. But scientists say he would have had different results if he had tossed the boomerang outside the orbiting outpost. The boomerang behaved no differently than on Earth, flying back to Doi after he threw it. He says it flew just like on Earth, and I was really surprised and impressed. Doi told his wife in a chat from space, according to Japan's Mainichi Daily News. The effect is similar to tilting a bicycle while it is moving, an act that makes the bicycle turn, he says. Uneven forces on a boomerang as it moves through the air cause it to turn in a similar way. During January alone this year, 170 inches of snow fell at the Alta ski area near Salt Lake City, Utah, more than twice the normal amount for the month, eclipsing the previous record of 168 inches that fell in 1967. At the end of February, seasonal precipitation for the 2000 water year, which began on October 1st, 2007, was well above average over much of the West. And I can tell you, it added another inch this morning. Ken, in this hour, let's get more into the precision of the construction of the pyramid and maybe some of the methodology that this undertaking would require. One of the things that people don't realize, is because they've seen too many Egyptian specials on TV, maybe, there are 2,300,000 inner core blocks and 144,000 casing stones that make up the pyramid. Now, the casing stones have been scavenged over the centuries, but nevertheless, you know, how long do the records say it took to build this structure?
Well, the person that the traditionalists like to use as their support for the fact that they believe it was built in 30 years, which would have been almost a mathematical impossibility, was Herodotus. And Herodotus, of course, was known as the father of history. And he was, of course, from Greece, 4th or 5th century, somewhere in there. And he went to Cairo because he was fascinated with the whole culture, the Egyptian culture. But he got there about 300 B.C. Well, that meant that the pyramid had been built 2,700 to 2,800 years before he got there. So where did he get his knowledge from, and how did he put together this extrapolation that it took 30 years? And so when you consider that each one of these blocks weighed between the inner core blocks weighed between 3 and 5 tons, and the outer casing stones, which were made out of this Turo white limestone, weighed about 15 tons, and you do the math, there's just no way that they could have assembled all of those, brought them, you know, to the Giza Plateau, and assembled them in 30 years. When you stop to consider just the how long it must have taken them just to get the base of the pyramid foundation level, which was an incredible feat, because they had to cut down into the hard granite of the Giza Plateau and totally level that thing so that all of those stones would lay in such a way that they wouldn't separate as they built up. That must have taken a long time to do that.
How
they did it, we don't even know.
What are we talking about?
It probably took over 100 years or more, you know, just to build it, because so much engineering went into it. I mean, you think of the base of the pyramid being curved. What kind of engineering problems would that have created to make a curved base? And every one of those stones would have had to been, you know, facilitated to meet the contour of those curves all the way to the top. And then, you know, there were some enormous granite blocks that weighed 60 to 80 tons that were brought down from Aswan. I went up there to film, you know, the quarry, and that's in my second film. And how they got them down the river, nobody knows. The Nile, you know, wasn't controlled in those days. It was pretty flat. Any ship carrying that would have sunk in the mud.
Yeah, let me ask you a question about
that. It just would have been impossible feat to put in those 80-ton stones up around the King's Chamber. So, you know, 30 years is just not possible.
Let me ask you a question about that. How Are there any of these 80-ton blocks on the bottom of the river from a barge capsizing? I mean,
they don't have any of those, not to my knowledge. I don't think it could have been possible to put them on a barge. The barge would have sunk in the mud, and just, you know, if you had 80 tons on a barge, just one inch off and the thing's going to turn over. I mean, just the physics of that much weight on a barge. They didn't even have, there's no record of barges that big. I mean, I've been over there many times, and there's not, in the Egyptian Museum, the Cairns, there's nothing like that. So they must have been brought overland. And that's, you know, Aswan is a long way up the Nile, you know, to Upper Egypt.
How far
is it? I would say, let's see. It's Luxor is about, let's see, I'm having to think, it's got to be 700 miles, 700 miles, let's say 500-600 miles to Aswan. They would have to bring 80-ton blocks down river, and I don't think they used barges. I think they came overland. How they did it, I don't know. But, nobody knows for sure. But the fact that they were put on barges, the idea that they were put on barges to me is ludicrous. They would have had ships big enough. They would have sunk in the mud, and I mean, just bringing those blocks down the river would have been taken a long time. And then how do you lift them off the barges? Then how do you get them up to the top of the pyramid? They had to go up about 150 to 200 feet up into the air to put them on top. They were the joists for the king's chamber to hold an enormous weight, and then. What about the engineering difficulties of all the chambers inside? You know, I mean, the Grand Gallery was huge.
Where would they have gotten the wood to build a barge large enough? And if they did build a barge large enough, I can see it floating downriver. But how do you get it back upriver?
Yeah, the Nile's pretty swift, all right. Yeah, I mean, there's so many problems that the idea of a 30-year period in which they built it, I did the calculations. They would have had to lay a stone every 1.5 minutes for 20 years just for the inner core blocks, not counting the casing stones of the big 80 tons, every minute and a half. I mean, that's 24/7, and they didn't have lights at night, so, you know, and then they had the big rainy seasons where the Nile flooded, they couldn't do any work. So the idea of Herodotus' calculations are absurd.
If you think it took 100 years to build it, I can tell you, I've been an engineer all my life, engineering doesn't stay consistent year after year. I mean, look at cars 30 years ago compared to now. Engineering changes. It appears as though the engineering for the pyramid is consistent from the granite floor all the way to the nearly finished capstone at the top. How would one keep engineering consistent over a 100-year period? That's like four lifetimes of engineers.
Well, the reason they have to go for 30 years is because they got to somehow make it close to the lifespan of Khufu. And he only reigned for 23 years. So that means they would have had to start it before he was born. And so they're trying to, you know, fit it all into this guy's lifespan. And it just doesn't work. Another thing that you find about the Great Pyramid, if Khufu built it, was in the inventory stela, he claimed that he didn't build it. He claimed that he just did repair work on it. But he did claim that he built the three pyramids just to the east of the Great Pyramid. They're maybe 100 or 200 feet from the Great Pyramid. And those pyramids were actually tombs of his mother and his two wives. And they're like maybe, I don't know, only maybe 30 feet high at the most, you know. And all of those pyramids, when you study them, are not built with any of the carefulness of the Great Pyramid. In other words, sometimes you see smaller stones at the foundation of those pyramids, and then they get bigger, and then they get smaller to the top. And they're not consistently in the same style as the Great Pyramid. So you go, well, if Khufu built the Great Pyramid, how come maybe he didn't like his mother or his two wives? They didn't care that much, but it doesn't make any sense that he would be that, you know, artistic in the Great Pyramid, and then with the three to the east, that they look like, in fact, they're falling apart, and they just are not built with the same fingerprints as the designer of the Great Pyramid.
Well, I think you're being too kind. When I look at your film, and by the way, the high definition film that you use to make this documentary is really clear. It's really, really amazingly clear. But one of the things that you notice is that these other pyramids, reportedly built by the same architect that built the Great Pyramid, are nothing more than a pile of gravel compared to the Great Pyramid.
Yeah, that's right.
I was going to ask you, how could a 15-ton block be cut precisely on six sides with tools available in the days claimed to be the construction period of the pyramid by the Egyptians?
Well, that's the big question. Nobody knows. There's no answers. One of my experts in my film explains this Mohs scale, you know, which is the hardness of certain metals. And all we know is that they had copper tools, but the copper was softer than the limestone that it was trying to cut. So how did they do it? Nobody knows. Nobody can explain it.
Isn't that a little like trying to punch holes in stainless steel with a frozen banana?
Exactly. That's exactly right. So, you know, it took superior intelligence to know how to cut those blocks and quarry them and then move them and then set them in place. And there's all kinds of theories, but the point of it is that this pyramid was built with such precision that the builder knew that it had to weather all of human time, because the prophecy contained in it had to stay intact until humans wake up to the meaning of it. And I think that our films are going to bring a tremendous consciousness of what the real meaning of the pyramid is and who built it. And the builder was a supernatural person that,
before we get into the
left the earth without dying.
Before we get into the supernatural of it, let's not leave this technology just yet. If it required superior engineering, superior intelligence, obviously way, way advanced engineering, and advanced tools, why build it out of rock? Why not build it out of steel or titanium or other elements that were available on the earth? Why would they build it out of stone?
I don't know. I mean, certainly, you know, everything was available then that is now, but at least I guess at that time this was the decision. And I can't explain why they didn't do it out of steel. I mean, steel wasn't around, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years, but I guess maybe in that area there wasn't enough iron. Maybe they didn't understand iron. But they made it out of rock, and it was recorded by Josephus in the first century. You know, he explained that it would be the sons of Seth, the lineage from Adam, that would be the ones that would master the understanding of the stars. And we know that metallurgy developed, you know, early in those times. And this is what they were allowed to know at that time. Steel wasn't an invention until way into the future. But, I mean, I guess it could have happened that way, but I don't know the answer.
You know, when you travel Egypt, there is hardly a building, an ancient building, that doesn't have some kind of hieroglyph, some kind of picture, some kind of drawing. And by the way, the cleanliness and the consistency of this artwork, not just the hieroglyphs, but also the depictions of human bodies and tools and rituals and things that they did in those days, they're all immaculate. And all that acreage of artwork over hundreds and hundreds of years, there's not a single depiction of anyone building a pyramid. Why?
Yeah, and not only is there no depiction of anybody building a pyramid, I'll tell you the answer, what I think the answer is, but there's no hieroglyphics on or inside of the Great Pyramids, which is inconsistent with their temples and other pyramids in Egypt. Why is there no hieroglyphics inside the Great Pyramid? Why is there no honor given to the gods, you know, that they worship? But there's nothing in the Great Pyramid that indicates that it's Egyptian. Nothing. But
well,
let me answer the question.
Okay.
Why don't they have any depiction of people building pyramids? And I think the answer to that is because it was a sacrament. It was something that was considered holy to those people. You know, they say, well, slaves built the Great Pyramid and the pyramids, some people say, well, it was the Jews that built the Great Pyramid, which is totally ridiculous because there weren't any Jews until after the end of pyramid building. So that whole story by Menachem Begin is a joke. And yet,
yeah,
what pyramid building was the involvement of the whole community, the whole civilization was involved in pyramid building because it was a sacrament. It was holy. And it was not to be put on, profaned. The whole sacrament wasn't to be profaned by making pictures of it. That's my explanation for it. Is that it was just too sacred to have any depictions of it. But it took the whole civilization to build a pyramid and all the resources of the pharaoh to build it. And it was something that was to memorialize this event where Enoch left the earth without dying. You know, think about that. How would you respond if I told you, tomorrow I'm leaving on a ship. I'm going to come out to your place. They're going to pick me up outside your house. I'm leaving on a ship. I'm leaving. I mean, what would that do to your mind? It would blow your mind. And that's what happened to these people. That's why the Egyptian religion was fixated on the stars, because that's where Enoch went. He went into the stars. We would feel the same way. You know, if you saw a UFO land and somebody get on and leave, you know, you just would never be the same again. Your life would be totally different. And that's what happened to these people. Their lives were so affected that all they could think about was, you know, the eternal day, making it to eternity.
There are several civilizations that talk about coming from the stars. The Hopi people, the Zulus, even the Eskimos talk about being coming from star travelers. And even if you go down to Tula or Teotihuacan, there are lots of evidences there of whole high-tech cities just abandoned, just left alone. So Enoch probably wasn't the first one, nor the last one, to leave the planet on a ship and not experience death. But it's kind of interesting how this lays groundwork for an event that was going to happen a few thousand years in the future, and obviously changed society since that day, 2,000 years ago. We just got done celebrating Easter. There is this story of a being who comes to Earth, a higher being, a son of God, or a god himself, lives on the earth, dies, and is resurrected. But that story is not unique with Jesus of Nazareth. In fact, Jesus lived in Egypt as an exile from the Jerusalem area because of the rule of Herod at the time. And his family, and he, Jesus grew up in boyhood in Egypt. So it is absolutely irrefutable that he saw the pyramids. He knew the story behind the pyramids, the current one in 2,000 years ago, or now 2,008 years ago. And we're going to talk about that story in some detail, because there
are... Now, you know, what's interesting about Jesus going to Egypt, because he did go to Egypt, was the first place that he and his mother and father, his earthly father, Joseph, the first place where they went was Hermopolis. They went to this ancient city of Chem, which was the home base of Thoth, who was Enoch. And most people don't understand that the Egyptian religion wasn't polytheistic. It wasn't paganism. It started monotheistically. And later, Akhenaten tried to turn Egypt back to monotheism. Well, it lasted for two decades, but Egyptian religion actually was, at the beginning, monotheistic, and that's a big debate going on out there concerning that. But I think it's interesting that Jesus and his mother and father went to Chem, which was the home base of Thoth, who was Hermes, who was Dahuti, who was Enoch.
Do you think they made it out to Abydos? Do you think that they...
Abydos?
Yeah.
Abydos, I don't know about Abydos. I think after they were in Chem, they went south towards Cairo.
Okay, I see. So now outside Cairo...
They went north towards Cairo.
Okay, so then they had to go by Saqqara, and they had to go by Abusir, and in between those two is a little place not very well known called Abu Ghraib. Have you made your way there?
I've never been to that place. I've been to the others, and of course they're just south of Cairo or Giza,
but
the one you spoke of I have not been to.
Now, what did you think of Abusir first? Let's talk about that.
Well, I approached Abusir from the north, And it was, Abusir was hard to get into. I mean, it's amazing how they protect these places from allowing you to film there. You know, Dr. Hawass is, sits over the pyramids like they're his little eggs to hatch. And it's very difficult to get any work done there, especially if you go in as a big film crew. So we have to sneak in to get any filming done. And we have to be very crafty about how we go about it, because our view is so threatening to the historical viewpoint of traditional Egypt history that, we really are rocking the boat with him. So we have to sneak in there, and I have to take guides that take me back routes, and that's what we do. But I loved Abusir, and I had to trek in there, by paying off the guards. So it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it, and it was really, seeing the fifth dynasty, that's where the fifth dynasty pyramids are, and they're all falling apart, which then you go, if they were the fifth dynasty, you'd think that they progress from the fourth and get better, but they actually are falling apart. All of them are just like almost rubble now.
Well, what did you think, though? You walked through the temple, which is just to the east of the little pyramid they call Abusir. Did you notice the polished basalt floors?
I didn't notice the salt floors. At that time when we were going through that temple, all I was noticing was how they kept records of their Egyptian hieroglyphics on everything,
right.
And my guide was warning me we gotta hurry because, the cops are coming. So we had a hard time getting anything done in that temple because we were we had walked into the other side. By the time we got to that temple, our visitation was being cut short, so I didn't notice those floors.
Well, next time you get there, try to spend a little time on that temple, and go in the wintertime because it's really low pyramid or
traffic.
Low tourist season. But it's not a very big temple, and it is in very bad shape. It's all falling apart. But
right.
The red granite is machined unbelievably precise. I mean, almost like sprockets cut into it, and the polished basalt floor. This is a black stone that's just almost as hard as diamond. We drill into it out here for water, and it's just really tough to get through, even with tungsten carbide. But embedded in the floor are these granite base stones, and then standing on the base stones are limestone pillars. So you're going, now wait a minute here. I got a black floor. I got red granite stone set in it, and then I got a white limestone pillar on top of that. A woman designed this temple. I'm sure she walked in and she said, no, the floors will be black, and I want that red granite I saw up in Aswan, which is 300 miles to the north, by the way.
That's great.
I want you to haul that down here, machine it round, and embed it in this floor. And it's really wild to see this flagrant use of technology just for looks.
Yeah.
So in between Abusir and Saqqara is a really blown-apart structure called Abu Ghraib. It's also very, very difficult to get to. But it is a machine. It's probably the largest machined single piece of alabaster on Earth. And it will absolutely blow your mind. What in the world were they doing when this is a round piece of alabaster? It's probably 6 feet tall, embedded down into a square piece of alabaster, and around it are these machined alabaster bowls that have sprockets machined in around the top of them. They're about 2 meters across. Utterly stunning to see, and there's all kinds of theories what they were used for. The British came down in there at the turn of the 20th century to come up with their ideas, but my gosh, we were barely flying biplanes then. We don't really know what it's used for, but for sure, there is some amazing technology here at the foothills of Memphis that nobody can explain.
Yeah. I have no comment on it because I haven't been there to see it, but I don't know what to say about that.
Well, what did you think about Saqqara? You made it somewhere in your film that people don't normally get, and that's underneath Saqqara. How did you get
there? That was lucky. I mean, that was we were there, and we just, these guys were in the, you can't get under there. We managed to get down under there and do some work underneath the step pyramid, and we were just one of those days where you just you're just, it's just all the biorhythms are right or something. We just got in there and got underneath. And there again, you know, underneath the step pyramid, third dynasty, you see hieroglyphics and wall paintings, but you don't see it in the fourth dynasty. And you go, well, why not? I mean, why did they continue the tradition of what the Egyptians do? And they just paint and they carve and they make stuff and they put their historical, they put their, you know, cultural behavior on the walls and their gods, but nothing in the Great Pyramid. There's nothing, which suggests that it wasn't built by the Egyptians. It was built before the pharaonic dynasties began by Enoch, who was called Thoth, and this amazing, mythological god who wasn't a mythology at all. He's a real person.
Well, as they venerate Enoch, and they call him Tehodi or Thoth or the record keeper, the one who crafted the emerald plates people talk about, sort of the judge, man whose honor is impeccable and about whom we can trust everything he says, even these...
Exactly, what they talk about in the epitaph, exactly.
Yeah, here is this man who left a legacy that literally covers every single major edifice in Egypt. And yet his teachings, his understandings of our place in the galaxy, our place in the universe, our place in the dimensions, and the fact that we might even possibly be eternal beings having a mortal experience, it seems that this was missed somehow by the modern Egyptian culture.
Well, in a way it wasn't, in a way it wasn't. Like, for example, if you go to Hermopolis, by the way, again, Hermopolis comes from the Grecian word, a god, Hermes. The word Hermes, we get the word hermetically sealed, which the Great Pyramid was. We get the word hermeneutics, which is the Christian mythology for studying messages, hermeneutics. Amazing name in history. And we find that he was also not only depicted as an ibis bird with a curved beak, and that's because the curved beak was representative of the moon, the crescent moon. And today, you know, the Muslims don't even realize over their mosques they have a moon, a crescent moon. It's a representation of Thoth, the moon god. But he wasn't really a moon god in the sense that people think. He was a moon god in the sense that he studied the moon and got the movements of the moon over, studying it through the ceiling of the Grand Gower, where he saw the moon move from solstice to solstice, and he figured out that it took 12 lunar cycles, and they created a lunar calendar. In that sense, he was the moon god. But he also was depicted as an ape or a baboon. And the reason for that was because in the morning before the light came up, the baboons would chatter and they'd screech and scream. And that's because they were announcing that the dawn was coming. And the idea of that was that the new day represented, every new day represents the eternal day. And the book of Thoth called in modern times the Egyptian Book of the Dead, but its original title was the Book of the Eternal Day. And there again you have a whole paradigm shift on how people view Egyptian, ancient Egyptian, anteriorities as, darkness and dead. But actually, the book was called the Book of the Eternal Day because it was all about eternity. And the whole concept for the Egyptian religion was how to get there, how to become eternal. Because that's what they saw Enoch become in terms of never dying. So in the Egyptian culture, you do have records of this, but it's been, over time, the real truth of it's been lost, but you still find it in the Egyptian culture. The Book of the Eternal Day now has been changed to the Book of the Egyptian Dead, Egyptian Book of the Dead. So you see over time, these people translate and change things, just like, the whole concept of the angels, being changed into sinister, aliens from H.G. Wells and, Schiaparelli's view of Mars. So that's what happens over time. People's bias tends towards darkness because that's the human predicament. You know, we see darkly. We cannot see the light because we're trapped in a consciousness that is bound to Earth. And actually, the whole issue of of our life is to transcend our human nature and become more godlike. But that's another story. But anyway, that in the Egyptian culture, you do have these inklings why there's no, conspicuous by its absence, there's no pyramid building on the walls. Why? Because it was really important to these people, so important that it was holy, it was forbidden. Because it was, in the old days, there were what would they call the blue laws. You weren't allowed to do anything on Saturday because it was too holy, and that's kind of, the way people went about their observance of the meaning of Enoch's, leaving the earth and the whole purpose of reproducing pyramids as a sacrament in honor of that event, and it became a tradition.
Well, that's interesting. Let's talk a little bit about that icon of the moon. I was just doing a little bit of thinking here. It looks like in Islam, the moon has a very important place in the imagery of their religion. And also the Tibetans at the top of their stupa above this, what looks like a Stargate machine that they depicted in their burial chambers for Panchen Lamas and Dalai Lamas, is also a crescent moon. Do you think that all this also ties to the iconology of Enoch?
Absolutely. It's like, during the time of Abraham, what happened, in my view, was his genius and his intelligence was so transcendental. He understood, mathematical equations and science and chemistry and atomic measures and weights, and he was just and all of these things. I mean, I've got in my hand at least 200 epitaphs of this epitaph of Dahuti, and when you read about him, this is somebody that was not only venerated, but he was well known, and for many different facets of his character. And so he was so prolific during that time that his fame became a renown. Well, when people talk how they embellish things, and pretty soon he became idolized. He was put up on a pedestal, and he was idolized. Then he became deified, and then mythologized. And over hundreds of years, the true reality of who he was, just a man, but somehow a super natural guy that didn't die. It just impacted the world in such a way that by the time Abraham came, who was the father of the Semites, about 2000 B.C., the whole Fertile Crescent worshipped, probably the Fertile Crescent had to do with the crescent-shaped moon, but they actually were into the worship of the moon god. And it proliferated throughout time, and to this day, like I said, the Muslims don't even realize that their crescent moon over their mosques is a representation of Thoth, who was Enoch, and they don't even know why it's there. They can't even tell you. But that's the reason for it, and it was all over the world. It affected the whole world. It affected the way we even think about just stuff that we do every day. Well, like I said, hermetically sealed has a certain meaning to it, but comes from Hermes, who was the one that sealed messages. He sealed the pyramid. Hermeneutics, the whole study of messages, is what's ensconced into the whole title of the Christian study of the Bible. It's incredible, the power and the effect of this person on history.
How long did Enoch live?
He lived 365 years, which I think is really phenomenal, because when you study the base of the pyramid, it's 365 Egyptian cubits, and I mentioned in my film that it's almost as though the number of years that he lived is ensconced into the design of the Great Pyramid's base, because when you measure it, in connection with the what was known as the Egyptian sacred cubit, which was 25 inches, the Great Pyramid's base, each base length is 365.25 inches. And so, then it says he was taken and he was not, for God took him, or Elohim took him. It doesn't say that Jehovah took him, it says Elohim took him, which means the angels took him. Because Elohim is a plural of Eloah, as I said earlier, so it was these angels. And that word is defined in Psalms 82 of the Old Testament as God, small g. The gods took him, and he was not. So it's as though his name and who he was and the number of years he lived is built into the mathematics of the base of the pyramid.
Do you think in that 365 years, do you think Enoch spent all of his time in the Middle East, or do you think he traveled the world and taught other cultures and tried to make sure that they also had a chance at prolification?
I don't know. There's stories that, you know, he was behind the... There are stories, and I don't know if it's true or not. I really couldn't tell you. I will learn of this because I'm in contact with the people who do know this, but that he was involved in this construction of Stonehenge and that he first lived up in the British Isles and then came down into Cairo area to build a great pyramid with the knowledge that he took of the movements of the sun. Because, you know, the Ouija'd eye in Egypt is the all-seeing eye, and it both has a one eye relates to the sun and one eye relates to the moon. And so, it, you know, over the years, you know, because of the Masonic symbolism of the all-seeing eye, it's taken on, again, you know, an evil taint to it. But the all-seeing eye of Ra actually was, you know, the clarity of vision of God. In fact, it's over the door of the lintel of the Great Pyramid. People have never noticed it before, but that's in my third film, The All-Seeing Eye. That will be, you know, the kind of like jump-off point for dealing with the Enochian Mysteries of the Enochian Priesthood, which will be our next trilogy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Stonehenge and about...
I don't know very much about Stonehenge. I mean, there's stories about that, but I certainly don't... I'm not knowledgeable of that. I mean, I've studied read it, but I'm not somebody that can speak on that.
What about the fact that the square and the compass, which are ancient tools of stone masons, which is where the word masonry came from, and the fact that this is deeply ensconced in Celtic culture, all of these mathematical patterns and relationships between dimensions and time and the eternality of the soul are all things that are, well, I guess they were called pagan or they were called Gnostic, but they were systematically rooted out and literally burned at the stake as, quote, Christian governments like those set up by, you mentioned Constantine with his amazing coup called the Council of Nicaea, where he literally beheaded metropolitan bishops that didn't accept his view of what church government should be like. If it's possible that Enoch came from these regions, it's possible that he was Nordic or that he was even of a different race than those who existed in the Middle East.
Well, it says Enoch was from the lineage of Adam, and Adam means red. So until the time of the Noahic flood, and thereafter when mutations began because of the radiation of the sun, most likely when we think of Nordic, we think of white-skinned people, but I don't think that Enoch was white-skinned. I think he was red-skinned or dark-skinned person. Because he was a seventh generation from Adam, or Red, there were actually people that lived before Adam, but he was the first aura-souled human, different than the people that lived before him. But Adam was Red, and that's what his name means. And since he came through the lineage of Seth, according to Josephus, the Jewish historian in the first century, and because we have biblical records of the same from the books of Moses, I think Enoch was red or dark-skinned.
That
is not Nordic.
That's something I never knew before. I never knew that the word Adam meant red.
Yeah.
But I did know that there were at least human beings, maybe not advanced higher Adam beings like Adam, but even in Genesis it says that... there were clearly two creations, one where man and woman were placed on the earth and allowed to proliferate and till the earth, and then much, much later, Adam is created. And he, even according to the Genesis accounts, lives on the earth for practically 1,000 years before Eve is brought to him. So he has no progeny until much, much later in his life. So it's really interesting how all this fits together and how powerful, what the powerful meanings are for our modern race. Now, I know you've probably thought about this. You didn't mention it in this film. Perhaps you will in the next. Do you think
that Enoch is coming back.
Well, yeah. You know, it says that Enoch, I do believe Enoch is coming back, and I do believe that he's coming with 10,000 planetoids, or ships. And it says it in the Gospels. It says, at the end of the age, he will send forth his messengers, or angels, and he will gather his elect from the four winds. And the four winds means, it's a metaphor of the four splinters of humanity, because humanity splintered into four races, general races. One was from the progeny of Enoch, and then of the sons of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So when you see the squared face in the book of Ezekiel, it's a representation of which have four faces, is a representation of the four splinters off from after the flood story. And so he will gather his elect from the four winds, so that there will be a departure of elect people from the earth by those sent under the lordship of Yahweh-El via Enoch and the race that was populated on Arcturus to gather the elect, which would be God's chosen. So the Gospels tell this story. There's been a lot of false teachings recently about this, the whole concept about this rapture, and all that, and that's distortions of the idea of this whole gathering. But yes, Enoch, it does say it in the book of Jude, and it's prophesied that he will come with 10,000 of the saints, and the saints, that's a word, like another generic word, like chariot, or like in the book of, like, you're a science show, but there's a really tremendous things, that are merging. For example, the Christian world believes that the creation was made in 7 24-hour days, which is totally ridiculous. But they get that idea from mistranslations of the original text, which says, "And the morning and the evening were the first day." But actually, the real Hebraic sense of that is the dawnings and the settings, which was the first age. So the word there for day is the word yom in Hebrew, which is a generic word, and it could mean a lengthy period of time. It could mean a 24-hour day period. But they always have a literal, interpretation of it, but an age could be millions of years.
Sure.
So the evening and the morning was the first yom, or the first age.
So
Enoch prophesied that he's coming at a time at the end of an age.
Even people that read the Bible know that the earth, in the creation, even in Genesis, the earth didn't get a sun and a moon until the third day.
Yeah.
So the idea that the earth was created in 7 24-hour days is definitely a modern interpretation.
Absolutely.
And the word rapture and the idea of rapture doesn't even exist anywhere, nowhere in the Bible. It exists totally post-biblical, and it is absolutely modern philosophy that has been called the doctrine of God, and it is, for all intents and purposes, even scientifically speaking, blasphemy.
The Bible teaches a Big Bang, and Christians don't believe that, but in the book of Revelation, it says, and I believe it's in the 10th chapter, it says there's this guy John, the one that received the revelation, where there's this little book, the little book of thunders, it's called, and there's seven thunders that come out of this book, and he's instructed not to write it down, but to eat the book, and it will be sweet in his mouth, but bitter in his stomach, meaning that the knowledge of these things is sweet, but to convey it is very difficult. It's bitter because people aren't going to receive it. But the idea of it is that in the comprehensive view of how things are made, there's actually been seven thunders or seven big bangs. And what happens is that everything starts from a star density compaction, and then it explodes, and that's what creates the universes. And there's been seven universes, and they all go out in this first pattern called the alpha mode, and they stretch. And it constantly throughout the Old Testament says God stretches forth the heavens, and that's exactly what's been happening for 15 billion years since the first thunder, or since the last thunder, I should say. And then what happens, there's a signal that goes out into the sound line, or what I call the soundtron, which is the voice print of God in all the atoms, and then it retracts and goes into a omega mode and goes back into a compaction, and then it starts all over again. It's cyclical. And there's been seven thunders, or seven big bangs, and seven expanses, and seven contractions. And if you read in the book of Peter, it says that the elements will melt with fervent heat, and that's because it goes back into the next compaction, and there'll be a new heavens and a new earth, because God keeps making more universes, and he keeps compacting them again. And that compaction is probably, you know, what people's misconstruction of hell is, when everything goes back into a compaction, all the physical universe is dissolved into a compaction. And that's confirmed by science. But there's a big disconnect between the religious world and the scientific world, but the Bible is actually very scientific. If you don't read it in a linear capacity, but read it metaphorically, then the spirituality is supported by science. And that's what we need to see a healing in, because there's such a divide. But they're mutually, you know, they support one another.
Well, there was at one time a union between religion and science. And then, by necessity, they were separated, because religion or science became too religious, and blasphemy was met with ignorance, and then science was not allowed to move forward. And now, today, we're almost at the opposite end of that, although science has become very religious, in the sense that if you come up with new science, new geology or new physics, in order to get published, you have to be peer-reviewed, you have to be peer-accepted. And if that's not accepted, then no one is going to hear about it. We call that paranormal. And now the paranormal community makes up about 90% of the scientific community, and 10% is more or less the canonized scientific community that believes that the Earth is basically flat, and time is linear, and all those other wonderful misnomers.
Exactly.
And that's what we do, is explore that here on this program. Now, one of the interesting things that you brought up is, you know, of course, we see this in supernovas, too, when supernovas, stars reach their last death throw before they go and become a black hole, is they burst this energy out and literally consume all the matter that's within the blast zone of that supernova. But in that blast, they create higher order elements. Everything moves from iron upwards into the periodic chart. And that's why we have such complex chemistry in our universe, is because of these bang events, these huge energetic discharges that create these high energy neutrons and pure energy to generate these higher order elements. Now, the interesting thing is that now we have this disconnection between science and religion, and what we really need is a reunion of the two, because it's clear from the records left behind, from everything we've been discussing tonight, that we are not just beings that burst into existence, live a mere 30 or 40 or 100 years, and then disappear. We live on, and Enoch is trying to leave us that message.
Absolutely true.
That's
great.
He wants to know this. So anyway, those are my thoughts about it, and I don't know if we can accomplish this reunion, but I did have a question about your gathering, about the 10,000 ships that are coming.
Right.
We've had people on this program who have talked about a very strange staging that appears to be going on. There is, by all accounts, a power structure that exists on this planet. It's a power structure of ignorance. It's a power structure of energy and of dominance. And it seems as though the world's population is being prepared for this possible day when 10,000 ships show up in our upper atmosphere, and we don't have the weapons to, quote, defend the world from invaders. Do you think that there is fear in the, quote, establishment community that we will not own the airspace above our planet very soon?
I don't know. I have some amazing documents. I haven't decided if I believe they're true or not, but concerning, you know, research and presidential letters that have been indicating, you know, this whole UFO phenomena for the last 50 years. And I do know that there are those that will interpret the visitation or this, you know, epiphany of these ships as they'll look at it as, you know, hostile. But it won't be hostile except to the people that are evil. It'll be received by those that are prepared. And so I think it's kind of both things going on at the same time. I think there's going to be an attempt to try to defend against, you know, this invasion of the airspace. And I think there are those that are expecting this to happen that are welcoming it. I'm one of the ones that is welcoming it. You know, I don't see it as, clones of entities that are evil. I know there's both sides of the story, but I also know the difference.
Define evil.
So I think both things are going on at the same time, and people will be confused. I mean, I think the Bible says that men's hearts will fail them.
Well,
know,
yes,
the
but
coming.
it also says that if it were possible, even the very elect will be deceived. It puts the if in there. So let me ask you this question. Define evil. I mean, everybody says that anybody that believes different than I believe, than my church or my corner or my book or my secret rite or whatever it is evil. So define evil. What does that mean?
Well, you know, in the universal constructions, there will always be a contradictory force to good. There'll always be, no matter when this universe ends and there's a new heavens, meaning the universal construction of this present universe, which isn't the universe is not the domain of God. It's called the expanse. It says God separated the waters below from the waters above, and in between He created the expanse. And the universe, which is at present calculated at 900 billion galaxies, is the expanse. But there's a waters above, and in the waters above, that's the domain of the Most High God. That's the domain of Eloah. And the waters below are the energies of the earth, and in between is the expanse. But the expanse is not the domain of God, the Most High. And in that domain of the expanse, there'll always be a positive and a negative charge, because all life has to evolve through conflict. That's just the way it is. And people that want to think that there shouldn't be conflict don't understand the construction of existence, because you cannot move forward unless you overcome the negative. So in the universal constructions, there's always going to be evil. And evil I characterize as anything that's contrary to the love of God. So anything
that is outside of the love of God to me is evil. Now we're getting somewhere. Now we're getting to definable terms that we can put some metrics on. You mentioned positive and negative. That's pretty easy to quantify. And I would add to that maybe light and darkness, or light and absence of light. And you mentioned one more, love, and it has its opposite, fear.
Or hate.
So,
or hatred.
Yeah, well, yeah, hatred is generated by fear or a lack of love for oneself. It's kind of interesting when you look at the teachings of Jesus. He never established a church. He never established a religion. Didn't even come close. In fact, if he did anything, he only left us two commandments. One was to love ourselves, and of course love our neighbors as ourselves, and then from that, loving God. I mean, in perfect Greek logic, he lays it out. Obviously, if you don't love yourself, you can't love anyone else, and you're certainly not going to love God. So let's go ahead and we'll wrap this hour up here in about 2 minutes. Let's re-mention here, because we're at the end of the second hour. The film is called The Great Pyramid, Lost Legend of Enoch. Now, it's the first in a series, And the second film has been completed. Is it for sale now on your website?
Yeah, it's called Message from the Stars. And by the way, if I might interject a thought here, my last name is spelled K-L-E-I-N. I'm a German
right.
Jew. I'm, that's a Jewish way to spell my name. So it's not. A lot of people spell it C-L-I-N-E, but it's not. It's K-E-N-K-L-E-I-N, KenKleinTV.com. You can also find me there, and I'm sure it's, I think it's on your website too, isn't it?
Right, right. Well, that,
so both
that,
of them are for sale, and they and you can download those too if you want to see them right away. You can save a few bucks and download it.
That's good. Well, we have several million people that cruise this site over the next 7 days, and as they're sitting at their workstation, they like to listen to the radio program while they're doing more mundane things on their workstation. And so you can just whip out your credit card or your PayPal account and whip over there and pick those up. We'll be back in about, I'm going to say about 3.5 minutes. And then we're going to finish off the third hour. And you really don't want to miss this because we're gonna split this wide open and see what the implications are for you. Something that means something before your next payday even. So don't go away. We'll be back. Friends down at NRG Resources have introduced the new engine oil technology. TBT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TBT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TBT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundation of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today.
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back. We're glad you're here with us at X Squared Radio.
Expand consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, March 30th, 2008. AccuWindow forecast says it's going to be cold tonight. We're going to try and keep you warm with this program. Definitely heating up here in the third hour. If you're not getting all 3 hours, please let us know, and we'll get with your affiliate and fix that. We also want to let you know we're coming to you through the BBS Radio Network and also through the SteelEye Media Network, both the largest internet talk radio networks on Earth. So we just recently learned that we are the number one talk radio program in Wales. So we are reaching out there. We also have a very large listening audience down under, and we appreciate that audience more than you know. We're trying to get a book distributor for you down there so that we can reduce the costs of shipping from the U.S. to Australia. This is a scientific talk radio program. We call it X Squared Radio because in here, the results are always positive. Of course, if you know your math, you know there is one number that can come up negative squaring it, and that is I. So I try to stay out of the way, let the guests tell their story. Let's do a little bit of news so we can get our guest Ken Klein back on. NASA may not be able to continue all its current science programs and pull off some bold new ones under a shrinking budget. According to U.S. politicians and scientists, we wonder what Obama's space policies are. It would seem that a pro-UFO disclosure would cinch the election, since 47% of Americans have actually seen one and believe the government is holding back what it knows about them. I wonder if he's interested in adding that to his platform. However, on Wednesday, NASA sent a letter to its Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, ordering that $4 million be cut from the funds remaining in the rover's $20 million budget for 2008 and that $8 million be cut in the 2009 budget. But after the rover team said late on Monday that this would mean temporarily shutting down the Spirit rover and curtailing the activities of the Opportunity rover, NASA signaled a change in the works, saying shutting down one of the rovers was not an option, according to a CNN story. Now, NASA says it has changed its mind about the cuts. The NASA administrator has rescinded the letter, says Dwayne Brown, a spokesman at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Just goes to show you, we really don't have a government in Washington. It's just a population of bureaucrats arguing over paychecks. Like many of his colleagues, Claudio Maxoni of the International Academy of Astronautics in Paris thinks that the moon's far side will one day be a haven for radio telescopes, free from the electronic chatter of Earth and the many satellites now orbiting it. Maxoni is calling on the United Nations to recognize an 1,820-kilometer diameter zone on the moon's far side as the protected antipodes
circle, a crater called Daedalus, within the area. Within this area would be suitable for a future radio astronomy base, he says, in Acta Astronica. This is the line with the Peace and Space Initiative put forth by Michael Sala 2 years ago. We'll see if the military community has something else in mind for the far side of the moon. And, of course, we'll bring you that news as well. Picture the scene. Aristarchus crater on the near side of the moon, 20 July 2019. It's only a few hours since NASA's Altair 2 landing craft touches down, and astronauts are walking on the lunar surface for the first time in almost half a century. Suddenly, a large area of the crater floor begins to convulse, and a titanic eruption of gas knocks the astronauts off their feet, and they look back to see their landing craft has disappeared in a cloud of dusty debris. That's what Arlen Krauts fears could happen to the next crew that lands on the moon. Krauts, an astrophysicist and cosmologist at Columbia University in New York, has analyzed over 1,500 accounts of strange lights on the moon, dubbed transient lunar phenomena. For decades, researchers have argued over whether TLPs are real or merely tricks of the imagination. We shall see. Better and better lenses are keeping more and more watch over the surface of the moon. One of the interesting things about the moon is the side that faces us is fairly dark. Its albedo is only 10%, which means only 10% of the sun's radiation reflects back out into space. But the far side of the moon has an albedo of 60%. That is to say, 60% of its solar radiation reflects back out into space. Why the half coating on the moon? It's an event called the Black Axiom, which will repeat itself in December of 2012. We'll see how that goes as well. Campaigners in the U.S. are attempting to delay the startup of the world's most powerful particle smasher with a lawsuit claiming it could spawn dangerous particles or mini black holes that will destroy the entire Earth. The lawsuit's claims are complete nonsense, James Gillies, a spokesman for a CERN, told the New Scientist. The LHC will start up this year, and it will produce all sorts of exciting new physics and knowledge about the universe, he said, adding, a year from now, the world will still be here. The collider will simulate conditions less than a billionth of a second after the Big Bang, by smashing protons together at enormous energies. Physicists hope to resolve long-standing questions such as why particles have mass and whether space has hidden extra dimensions. Kind of interesting. But Wagner and Sancho's court papers raise theoretical scenarios in which the LHC could create particles that gobble up the Earth, such as killer stranglets or strangelets. Strangelets are hypothetical blobs of matter containing strange quarks, as well as the unusual up and down types that make up ordinary matter. If a strangelet were stable and negatively charged, it might begin eating the nuclei of ordinary matter, converting them into strange matter. Eventually, the menacing chain reaction could assimilate our entire planet and everyone on it. A 2003 safety review for the LHC found, quote, no basis for any conceivable threat, close quote. It acknowledged that there's a small chance the accelerator could create short-lived mini black holes or exotic magnetic monopoles that destroy protons and ordinary atoms, but it concluded that neither scenario could lead to disaster. Kind of interesting. One of my friends was at CERN while they were testing. He was outside looking up at the sky with the group giving the tour, and all of a sudden there was sort of a light shaft, like a tear in the air above it, and he turned to the group and said, oh my gosh, did you see that? And of course the organizers said, see what? We didn't see anything. We shall see, as CERN is brought to full power, what happens.
My guest tonight is Ken Klein. His film is The Great Pyramid, Lost Legend of Enoch. His website is kenkleinproductions.net, and that's Klein, K-L-E-I-N. This film was the winner of the 2007 documentary film at Soundline Film Festival. I want you to get down there at that website and buy this film right now. There's also a second film out. We're going to talk about that and the implications from this right now. You won't see this on the cable channels because it clearly changes the franchise the Egyptians seem to have on the building of this remarkable structure. Ken, this is our third hour, and this is the hour where we kind of go beyond people's imaginations often. So let's talk about the implications of what all this means. It's clear that the Egyptians have no record whatsoever of building this structure or what it was used for or even how it was engineered. So let's talk about what this means for the human race and maybe even why it was left behind. Why do you think a structure was built to withstand the flood and whatever other cataclysms, including earthquakes, that could assault this area so that we would have it in our backyard today? Why do you think that is?
In the book of Job, which is the oldest book in the Bible, one of the statements made to Job was by the angels or the messengers, and they say, where were you when we laid the foundation stone of the earth? And the foundation of stone of the earth, in my view, and this is maybe a subjective statement, but the foundation stone of the earth is the Great Pyramid because it is a metaphor of the stars. In fact, it was discovered by Robert Bouval that the three pyramids on the Giza Plateau are reflections of the stars in the Belt of Orion. They're perfectly aligned with the stars in the Belt of Orion. The Egyptian religion is a star religion because it points to where we came from. We actually came from the stars. And so the word to Job was, you have not remembered from whence you came. Where were you? You were there, but you don't remember because coming into a human body, you've lost all memory. It's like you have a spiritual amnesia. You can't remember where you came from. You don't know why you're here, and you have no idea where you're going. And that's the plight and the condition of every human on this planet. Nobody knows why they're here. Everybody's searching through all kinds of means to find out what the meaning of existence is, where we came from, how it all happened, why we're here, what's going on. But the fact of the matter is, the book of Genesis tells us a lot, and so does the Great Pyramid. And the Great Pyramid is a prophecy in stone if we just look at it and take it apart. And that's what we do in the second film. We reverse engineer the Great Pyramid through computer graphics and break it down. And then we complete the whole understanding of what it is in the third film. And when you go to the end of my third film, which isn't produced yet, it is in post production, and we're only just a month away from its completion. The thing I leave you with, and I'm going to tell you what it is, because when you see it in computer graphics and the way we lay it out, it's just unbelievable. But when Enoch finished, getting the blueprints for the Great Pyramid, he left a seal of his identity in the antechamber. And that seal is commonly called the boss. And the boss is this, almost looks like a man's hand. It's like horseshoe shaped, upside down horseshoe. And that boss is an inch thick, and it's placed 25 inches from the wall. And it's understood that from that 25 inches is the derivation of the sacred Egyptian cubit. And the base, as I said earlier, is configured in 365 25 inches, which was considered the sacred Egyptian cubit. But the question is, why did he decide to make it 25 inches? Why did Enoch decide to make the Egyptian cubit 25 inches? And the mystery of it is so incredible, and when you see the meaning of that, you can't help but see that this information was granted to him by intergalactic angelic travelers who are trying to get our attention on the Earth, but we're so dumb and so darkened in our minds that we cannot ascend to the knowledge of it because we have to come out of this spiritual amnesia. And the meaning of the 25 inches is this, that the Earth, as you know, wobbles on its polar axis for different physics reasons, but it wobbles at the rate of about 26,000, that's not the exact number, but about 26,000 years it goes through one wobble. And that's called the precession of the equinox, as you know. It's not quite 26,000, it's a little bit under that. But if you could imagine this as a, if you were making blueprints for a house, and you were sitting there and designing a house, and let me say it this way, and so if you look at the pyramid today and you tilted it onto its side so that you're actually looking at the apex of the pyramid, which would be a point in the middle of it, let's say a square, and you drew a line from the left upper left side down to the right lower side, and from the upper right to the lower left, you would create two lines through the pyramid. And each one of those lines is exactly half the number of years in the precession of the equinox. And so those diagonal lines create the actual dimensionality of the base, which would be configured at 1 inch per year, okay, which equals the precession of the equinox. So the pyramid was designed in configuration with the number of years in the precession of the equinox because Enoch is trying to point us to the place where we came from. And so our existence here is related to the stars, and that's the message of the Great Pyramid. It's trying to tell us where we came from. It's trying to help us understand how we got here, and it's trying to help us grasp the understanding of our destiny. And that affects every human being on the planet. And so this series that I've created is for the world, so it will help human beings wake up to who they really are. Now, if you read the book of Genesis, it says, about the fifth or sixth verse in chapter 1, let us make man in our image. Okay? The Christian faith traditionally believe is that when it's speaking there concerning the word us and our, let us make man in our image, that it's a conversation that God's having with himself in the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. But the word that's used there for let us make man in our image is the word Elohim. And Elohim is a plural of Eloah, meaning gods. So it's the gods discussing the construction of the human being, which is made in the likeness of angels. So when it says in traditional doctrine that we're made in the image of God, it's not true. We're made in the image of angels. And so why is that so? And the answer is because we were the stars. We were the stars. We are the sons of God. But we've fallen. We've fallen to earth. We're the fallen stars that are mentioned in the book of Jude. And why have we fallen? Because we were the ones that were at war. We were involved in the angel wars. We were the angels that were at war. And now we're experiencing the judgment of living in a carnal form, in a state of spiritual blindness, because this is our judgment. And we're here because we're living out a judgment for the result of our indiscretions in going to war with each other in the heavenlies. And so this foundation stone is trying to get our attention. This pyramid is trying to help us understand why we're here, why we fell, where we fell from. We fell from the star area of Alpha Draconis, and we've fallen into flesh, and we're living out this terrible condition. We have spiritual amnesia at war with ourselves on this planet, and God is trying to get our attention through using angelic messengers to help us wake up to who we are, why we're in this condition, and how to transcend it and go back to where we came from. Because We are called the Ophanim lords, and we are the creators. We are the creators, and this universal construction it cannot go forward with new life forms in other parts of the universe without us. And so the angelic messengers are trying to redeem us and help us get back home to where we belong.
Well, that brings me to my question. There are 7 billion people living on the Earth right now.
Right.
And more than have ever lived on the Earth before. And there are many religions, even the Christian religion, that believe that as we fall short of evolution each time we come here, that maybe that we incarnate over and over again, and that now beings from all over the galaxy have come here because it's a key time. It's a pivotal moment in the race and also in the evolution of this planet. Do you think that all 7 billion people living here are of this fallen population, or do you think there are some enlightened ones here that are trying to light a candle, trying to help others make it?
Every human being born into this world is a fallen lord. I don't care if you're from Saudi Arabia and you're a Muslim, or if you're a Buddhist from China, or if you're a Christian. The Bible tells us that God is the light that lights every man that comes into the world. Every man is lighted with a dimension of light. And that's why there's so many different religions, because our genetic inheritance and our cultural biases affect the way we look at reality. But we're all really one. We're all really of one race. And that's from this race of fallen gods. And the key to our transcendence really is through the ministry of Christ. We all are of Christ, but we're all at different levels of light. And so in order to regain the light, we have to come through the one that brought the light, the light bearer, and that is Christ. And that's the only way back. That's the only way we can really get back. And the coming destruction is not coming to the universe first, it's coming to the earth, because we're going to get hit. The book of Revelation tells us we're going to get hit with an asteroid. And before that happens, there will be a select people that are taken in the Enochian, the angelic ships that are coming. But it's going to be hit. We're going to get hit by an asteroid, and a third of the world will be destroyed. A third of the earth will be destroyed, according to the Revelation. So, you know, that's why there's so much activity going on, because the time really is, I don't know in how many decades or hundreds of years or what, but I don't think it's coming tomorrow or in the year 2012. I don't go with that, but I think it's a longer period of time. But there is a collision that's going to happen from asteroids that are going to impact the Earth. And so there'll be a people that are be taken, you know, before that happens.
What if we knew why we are here?
We do know why. Well, I'm telling you, we're here to live out a judgment that's come upon us, because we committed a warfare in the heavenlies. And when a sperm hits an egg and a human lattice body is formed, that's when our spiritual being is thrown into that body lattice. And we have to live out a temporal life in the flesh. And it's like, you know, 70 to 100 years maybe if you get that much time. But we're here because we're in a temporary condition. God's eternal, you know. We are eternal creatures, but we don't really understand our identity as angels or messengers. We're failed messengers, and our brothers, the cherubim and seraphim lords and angels, are messengers, are trying to help us gain our sight. But they can't violate our free will. I mean, that never is taken from. We still have to make choices. So they're allowed certain universal liberties to attract our attention, but they cannot violate our will. That's a given. That's the first principle of creation, is freedom of choice. So we're sitting here, you know, having to make decisions, and they're only allowed so many liberties to get our attention. And the Great Pyramid is definitely a prophecy, an oracle.
Well, it's clear, at least from what you're saying and from what evidence that I've seen, that extraterrestrials are somehow held to this law that they cannot violate our free will.
Absolutely.
But it's pretty clear that terrestrials, people that live here on Earth, routinely violate another's free will. So
That's exactly true. And there's something in the human nature which is satanic, because in the nature of man is the desire to dominate his brother, dominance. And but if you look at Jesus, he came as a servant. He came serving and not trying to dominate. He came as a servant of servants. And the way we transcend is through servanthood. And so when you look at political figures, you know, their motive is pretty much self-centered, because on this planet we basically live in a prison. I mean, Earth life is a prison experience, no matter whether you're behind bars or just living out your life. And politics is basically people deciding who the warden's going to be, but that's about the best it is, because, you know, people that run for politics most of the time are self-motivated people desiring power and dominance as opposed to servanthood. And so the best political leaders are the servants, if they understand that principle at all. And so we have in the human race the condition of trying to make people slaves, when Christ came as a servant, or a doulos, it's explained in, you know, throughout the New Testament as a slave or servant, have made myself a slave to serve. That should be our motive, but, you know, we tend to default to self-exaltation rather than self-deprecation and servanthood. And that's what we have to overcome. We have to overcome that in ourselves.
Well, let me ask you a question. What happens if you don't get it in one lifetime, 70 to 100 years, what happens then?
Well, if you read, there's an interesting, throughout the scripture, you find, for example, like in the life of John the Baptist, you know, they said to Jesus, they said, you know, who is this guy? And he said, if you can receive it, he is Elijah. Now, Elijah lived, you know, right around the time, right after King David, which would have been about 700 or 800 B.C. And so Elijah had to come back through in the personality of John the Baptist. So the Bible does teach some kind of regeneration. And another example is when Jesus, they came to Jesus and they said, hey, Jesus, you know, how many times should we forgive our brother? And he said, they were thinking he was going to say maybe two times or three, but he said 70 times seven. And the reason he said that was because in the Old Testament, there's that equation is mentioned twice, once in the book of Leviticus and another in the book of Daniel, and it related to a generation in captivity. And what he's saying there is, in a generation in captivity was a lifespan. So he's saying, I'm going to forgive 770s or 70 lifespans. So there's scriptural basis for a regeneration. Where if somebody, for example, like in Saudi Arabia, never learned the way, or anybody that didn't have a fair time and chance, because we're judged on the basis of time and chance in fairness. So if somebody didn't have a fair, let's say, intelligence where they could grasp, you know, these celestial concepts, then they would be granted another lifespan to learn. So we're granted seven lifespans to transcend, according to the words of Jesus. So there is a teachings of regenerations in the Bible, but the Christian church doesn't understand it. It's been lost.
I've never heard that, seven lifespans to transcend. I kind of like the 70 times seven, although...
Yeah, well, that's 490 years, and 490 years is, you know, what these rapturists teach, you know, this last 7 years of Daniel's 70th week is, you know, the church is taken off the earth. It's not true doctrine, it's false doctrine. But Jesus taught seven times 70. He didn't say forgive all the time, and that's what all the teachers in the Christian church teach. He said seven. He spoke specifically of an equation of seven 70s, and 70 was clearly designed as a lifespan, a normal lifespan of a human, 70, 71 years or 70 years. So Jesus taught forgiveness seven times 70 because every human being, there's nobody expendable. I mean, God wants everybody to transcend. I mean, he wants everybody home. He wants everybody back into their celestial bodies, because even Isaiah in the 51st chapter says, haven't I called you that I might plant the heavens, that our destiny is to go into the stars and plant heavens and back to our role as creators, which we've lost. We've been stripped of all of our talent, power, and wisdom. You know, we've lost it all. We've been ruined. I mean, we're not supposed to live in this condition. This is temporary.
Death is
the doorway back, you know, but we have to grow here. We have to grow. And if we don't grow, then we have to go through again. And who wants to do that?
It is difficult to grow when you know everything and when you have all power. Then it is difficult to grow because you're not limited. You don't have to strain through eyelids or try to look past stars or try to worry about seeing 5 minutes into the future because you have that power. But limited in three dimensions and in physical form where we get cut and we get hurt and we love and we lose and we have pain and sickness, and then you have to learn all these things from scratch. I was going to ask you, how important is the year 2012?
Well, a lot of people put a stock in this as the end of the age, but I think that something pretty terrible is going to happen in the next 3 years economically to the world, because the world is based upon an economic system which is kind of funded by what we call fiat currency, which is bogus currency. It's by the declaration of the king, who is the political lords of the earth. And all that economy is going to be destroyed because of the fiat currencies are going to be destroyed. We're watching the destruction of the dollar, and all this crisis going on in our system is endemic, and it's going to be terrible in the next 2 to 3 years. And I don't see it as the end of the world or the end of the age, because God clearly spoke to Abraham and said, "I will." He's talked about a thousand generations. I'm the God unto Abraham for 1,000 generations. That's 70,000 years. So we're in a time of just the beginnings of that 70,000 years. We're like 5,000 or 6,000 years into the 70,000 years. So I don't see, an end in 2012, but I do see economically real difficulty coming over, all the nations, and people should be prepared for that. But I don't see it as the end of the age or the end of the world at all, because we still have that prophecy to Abraham, where we're only, maybe not even a tenth of the way into it yet. So there's a lot that's going to happen now and into the 1,000 generations that were prophesied to Abraham.
Well, what happens? I mean, it's obvious even to a casual observer that there are souls on the earth of different ages. And I don't care if you're 10 years old or 100 years old. Your soul, the wisdom of your being, how well you view your existence here on the earth, whether you can only live to the next payday or the next meal, or whether you're planning 2 or 3 generations away, depends upon the age of your soul, what kind of value you have on human life, and whether you're just an animal or whether you have evolved into a human being. So if 490 years is the total mortality that a soul gets, it's still a cosmic flashbulb. How long do you think it takes to fully develop a soul where they're ready to leave prison and go back to the galactic community from which they come?
Well, that's not an easy question to ask. I hope I'm on my last go-round, but I can't say. I don't know. It doesn't necessitate that you'd have to live 770s. You could perhaps transcend in less than that, but it's all about your choice and how you choose to, grow. I think most people think they just kind of live by reacting to what's going on from the external world rather than transcending by study and prayer and meditation. And so it's up to the individual to determine that. I don't think God determines that. He just allows for this, and then each individual has to make, the appropriate choices to step in the right direction, and that's always a day-by-day thing and a minute-by-minute thing. So I don't know if there's any answer to that except to say it's up to you. It's up to the person to decide, what they want. I want to, Jacob's ladder is a metaphor of climbing this staircase, and it's actually, a metaphor of a genetic strand. We have to overcome our genetics. We simply must overcome our culture and our genetics to transcend. And people, get involved in race wars and religious wars. They're just stupid in their flesh. They're just living like an animal. but we have to overcome our animal nature. We're a duality. We're a spiritual being and a physical being at the same time, and we have to choose whether we're going to be an animal or whether we're going to be an angel. And that's the choice people have to make every day, every minute of the day. And it's dependent upon that issue, your freedom of choice. And so you can grow as fast as you want or go the other way.
Ultimately, what you're saying, and I have a tendency to agree with this, we are our own judges, and we make our own choices as to what level of light we are going to assume. No
That's
one
right.
and no thing can do it for us. Now let me ask you this question. You know, there is this sense that, okay, I've made it, I'm across the abyss, and now I'm just going to wait for everyone else. But there's evidence that great beings who probably never needed to come here in the first place came here to teach, came here to uplift, and came here to help others get across. And maybe that there are beings on the earth right now who won't leave, even though they're qualified to leave, until every last soul is enlightened, knows who they are, and can make this jump.
When you die, there's a recording that takes place inside of you, like with like a pluses and minuses. It's almost like a binary clicker inside of you, okay? And that clicker we call the Beiling, and it passes from each cycle to cycle. And when you physically leave your body, your Beiling is opened by the seraphim lords, and they're like books, and your Beiling is read, and the determinations are made about what you can choose, whether you choose to move into a dignitary status and move on in the universal constructions, or whether you would like to return and further your destiny by doing more for your brothers and sisters. And that determination is also in your hand at that point. So what you're saying, I tend to agree with, you know. But those issues are based. Those determinations are based not on, like, when you die, whether you go to heaven or hell. It's based upon time and chance. Did on earth, did you have the appropriate time and opportunity to transcend? I mean, a lot of people are born with really bad IQs. I mean, they're really born in a terrible, genetic transference. Or they're born in a family where, you know, there's abuse and all kinds of things. So the determinations that are applied at that point are based upon time and chance. And so a lot of people don't have a fair time and chance. I mean, they just don't. And so
Get how about the, you mentioned the sperm and the egg about 40 minutes ago. How about the more than 33 million Americans who never got a chance to breathe air?
Exactly.
They were killed in amniotic fluid by their parents.
Exactly. And see, so the Christian people said, well, they just go be with Jesus, and I disagree. You know, they go to a state where a determination is made that they have a fair time and chance. If not, they get to come through again and have opportunity to transcend and overcome the prison of the body. The body lattice is called Tartaru. It's a level of hell in the Bible. It's not understood by Christianity, but Tartaru is this, we're bound up in emotional chains and mind circuits that are very limited, and we have to overcome that, you know. But if people are in a condition where they never have opportunity, well, then in the justice of God, there is the determination of made by the angelic lords that read the books or the Beiling records where, no, that person didn't have a fair time and chance. They get to have that. Because God couldn't be a just God and a loving God without that kind of determination. It would just be ridiculous. You know, a lot of times, you know, you look at people make the criticism to me. They say, well, you know, if God is so great, you know, just, how could he have the Jews kill all the Canaanites in the land of, you know, of Israel? They wiped everybody out. And one of the things that's really amazing about that argument is that they don't understand that if people are going in the wrong direction, let's say there's a serial murderer or something, you know. And he's definitely, you know, going into the animalistic stages where, you know, he's passing a point of no return, that if his life isn't shortened, then he wouldn't have a chance in the next lifetime. And so God often in the Old Testament days would wipe out all these people because they had so degenerated to animalistic forms that it was in his mercy to kill them. And that's what it says, in his mercy he killed them. You go, well, that's an oxymoron. How could that be? Well, if you don't understand the 70 times 7, you couldn't answer that. There's no answer. The truth of it is that God will often cut a life short if it's going in the wrong direction, and that's why a lot of these things, like when they talk about capital punishment, you know, well, it's wrong to put somebody to death if they're a murderer, and we should just give them a life sentence. Well, that's not mercy. That's prolonging the agony of somebody that can't deal with what happens to their conscience. And so it's actually an act of mercy to put them to death so the next time around they won't descend even farther. So we don't have a very good understanding of our existence. We don't have we're very, very in elementary school concerning the Bible. You know, even the most learned theologians really are basically in elementary school. And we don't have a good grasp of the totality and dimensionality of the scriptures because we're lost in dogma thanks to people like Constantine that routed out a lot of the things and formulated doctrines that are just not biblical, and then people live by them today and they're wrong and they blind you from the truth of what the scriptures are trying to tell us.
You know, I do have a tendency to agree with you. Sometimes when I wake up in the morning, it does feel like this body is hell. But there are some times when I walk outside and I look up at the sun, or I look at the flowers, or I listen to great music, and I say to myself, this, it really is heaven. It really is beautiful here. And there really is great love here. This earth is capable of such extremes, such terrible audacity, and such gorgeous art and love. It is a great experience to have a mortal life here. And maybe that's evidenced by great beings like Abraham and like Enoch and like Jesus coming here to have their mortal life. And there's also evidence of mortal lives that maybe get on the wrong track, even though it's quite an evolved soul. I look at the story of Saul, who, a good portion of his life was spent persecuting those who were trying to seek this resurrection from Jesus. And then he's approached, obviously, in the Bible, and approached by the dead Jesus, or at least Jesus that had transcended death, and told, Saul, you're on the wrong path, and by the way, 3 days from now, your new name is going to be Paul, and you're going to be one of my apostles instead of persecuting the saints, and here we have three-quarters of the New Testament because of him. So there is an interaction between, the divine and the transcendent being and a mortal being, and I also think that there are mortal beings who have chosen over and over again to live a mortal life here, even though they were well qualified to move on beyond this realm, just because of that level of love that they have.
In the Psalms, and then also in the book of Romans, there's some really interesting words that express kind of what you're saying, and that is, it says that the sound line of God goes out into all the stars. The stars declare the glory of God. And so the sound line and the word measure, which is used in coordinates with this psalm, is the word metron, or measure. So in everything, in all the atoms, is the voice print of God. So all the atoms are held together by the voice of God, which is a vibe. And so all of creation, even the atoms that compose your body, have the voice print of God in it. So all of creation radiates with the voice of God. All of it does. So you can go out and see the cyclical nature of nature itself and rejoice because it declares the glory of God. But we're still in a prism. We're still, while that, all that is true, we're still, you know, in a small little crummy planet in the extremities of a gigantic galaxy, lost in a sea of galaxies, and imprisoned in a consciousness that is truly a hell. Even though at times we can see through the bars of this prison to the beauty of the existence of God in all things and rejoice and say, wow, isn't this amazing? And it's true. It's true, but we're still not back in our original bodies where we were able to do what we did and strum the sound line like a guitar player would strum the chords on a guitar. That's what we used to do as we created. We strum the actual voice of God to create things. And so we're basically lost in a temporal condition because we're living out a sentence. Paul called it the sentence of death in the New Testament, you know, and couldn't wait to get out of his body and go back to where he came from. And so, yes, you know, it's both things. It's both of these things. Because I know I wake up and I look at the beauty of the creation and I say, well, praise God. I mean, God is great. You know, but I'm still in this miserable body. You know, I used to play pro football, and man, my body is messed up. I can't wake up in the morning without taking a, you know, ibuprofen to deal with the pain because I live in this stupid body that's falling apart. But you know, we have great hope before us, and we have a great destiny. You know, if we could just hook up with it and try to live it out, you know, and get over ourselves. That's the problem. We love ourselves too much. We need to love God and our neighbor. And get over ourselves and transcend ourselves and serve one another and love one another and become who we once were. That's what our challenge is.
Well, I agree with you, and I know that at least as far as I'm concerned, if you know you're lost, but you know pretty much where you are and why you're there, then at least you're free. At least you have the choice to move on. If you don't know you're lost, then you really are lost. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate your candor and going even into the spiritual realms of what is clearly an outstanding documentary with a lot of great science, a good methodology behind it. I highly recommend that you pick up this film, The Great Pyramid, Lost Legend of Enoch. And you need to get to this website. It's KenKleinProductions.net, and that's K-L-E-I-N Productions, because he's got a second film, and now he's got a third film out. And this trilogy is really going to open your eyes as to, it's going to tie you together with ancient civilizations that have been here, and off-world civilizations, and why all that ties together. My guest tonight has been Ken Klein. And Ken, I got to tell you, I really, really appreciate you coming on the program.
Well, I'll send you the second film, and maybe we'll do it again later.
Well, that's exactly my plan, because this is the kind of thing that we like to cover in depth on this program. It's always uplifting. It's always mind-opening. And the lack of phone calls tonight is evidence that this really is a great show, because all those people all around the world are just sitting by their computers going, I'm not calling in because I don't want to interrupt this train of thought. So we really have a respectful and eclectic audience all over the world. And clearly, I just want to let you know, we need you a lot worse than you need us. You really do.
Well, I'll come back. By the way, I've got a lot of free stuff on my website. There's a free tour of the pyramid on my site. You can go there and click on a virtual tour of the pyramid. A lot of essays and stuff. I think people will enjoy the site, and I hope they come and visit, even if they don't, you know, want to buy my film. They'll have a great time.
Great, great, wonderful, wonderful. I'll let you get back to your family. Have a great evening, and thank you for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate you.
Good night. All right, my friends, that's March 30th of X Squared Radio, and we will play our exit. We will see you next week. Same time. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest.
Remember, Earth explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth explorers.